This week on the show, Heroes Saved by the DVR, is freedom of speech un-Canadian, and the Web 2.0 winners and losers, right here on This Week in Media, number 155. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to This Week in Media. And I'm Alex Lindsay, and I'm going to be kind of doing the hosting. I'm co-hosting with Daisy. I just happen to be the one that's in the studio. Of course, coming in from a mere 15 miles away is Daisy Whitney.
I know. You may be wondering why I couldn't schlep up to Petaluma today, but I have a little girl who has a cough, so she's in her room taking a nap right now. Look how dedicated I am. I managed to show up at my house. So anyway, I'm here.
And also, we have a new victim, Michael Buckley from What the Buck Show. Hi, Michael.
I'm dedicated too. I put on pants for the occasion. I'm wearing sweatpants. Normally I would be in my boxer shorts, but I put on sweatpants just for you guys.
You know, you heard that we were a pretty serious show, I bet.
I can tell you. I saw your itinerary, your list of things to talk about. It's going to be a very serious half hour. I can taste it.
Yeah. So I see that, you know, now that you have your pants on, I think we can kind of move on and get moving here. So to move on into the news here, we have, okay, so here's the first news is TV. New TV shares its prediction for the 10 big things in 2009. Daisy, can you give us a little upshot of what this all means?
So basically, new TV, which is really well-read industry blog about online video and the business of it, has, I think it's probably its third annual conference, November 12th in San Francisco. So as part of that, the editors at New TV have picked 10 companies to watch in 2010? I don't know, they say 2009, but why would you make predictions for 2009? It's almost over. Anyway, so they're basically companies to keep your eye on that are doing well, that are getting traction. I don't think we need to go into all of them, but just some of the ones that stood out to me. Boxy is on the list, Demand Studios, Electric Farm, Visible Measures. And I highlight these companies because Boxy, you know, we've talked about Boxy a lot before. It's, you know, a software services company that basically can bring web video to the TV set. It's had some issues with Hulu, but is really gaining in terms of users. It's now up to more than 600,000 users. And then Demand Studios. This is really an interesting company because it's part of Demand Media, which has raised a ton of venture money. But Demand Studios really specializes in how-to video content, which, as we've talked about before, is very popular, does well, and is very low cost. Demand Studios is already profitable with that. And then you have Electric Farm Entertainment, which produced Gemini Division. Was that a year ago? Yeah, that was a year ago. And now is doing Woke Up Dead with John Hader and Val Lamont. And then Visible Measures, which is really measuring a ton of web video and traffic metrics, when people start watching a video, when they drop out, that sort of thing. So those are, I'm kind of highlighting the companies that I know best, but that also I think are probably poised to do well. So that kind of stands out to me in terms of who I like from this list.
I have to admit, I look at Boxy and I always go, you know, are they going to miss the, you know, they have 600,000 people, but now that Roku is really taken off, you know, I have a hard time seeing where they fit into the model.
Well, and sometimes the thing I wonder about with Boxy is, yes, it has 600,000 customers, but how many of those are actively using it? I mean, I'm still a Boxy customer, but I haven't used the service in months. And I interviewed them recently and I said, on camera too, this was for BTV. I go, look, your service is still kind of clunky. Is that going to get any better? And they have somebody that's working on user experience issues, which is really important. So I think it's an important company to watch because of its business proposition. But you're right. I think there's a lot of competition. And I, you know, Michael, here's a way to involve you in this conversation. You know, we talked a little bit about Visible Measures, which does measurement. I'm wondering, I've been curious, how do you measure your videos? Obviously there's the view count on YouTube, but do you use YouTube analytics? What sort of tools do you use to look at when people are dropping out of your videos? I mean, God forbid if they not watch the whole thing through, shame on them. But seriously, are you analyzing that at all?
I actually do. In the Insight feature that we all have to look at our YouTube videos. They have something called hotspots, and you can see, and it's so interesting how, like, I made my opening credits shorter because I realized I saw that people were dropping out during the opening credits seemed too long. And then I really look at the topics, and I swear to God, every time I talk about, like, Lindsay Lohan or somebody who's not that popular, everybody leaves. Like, it's like I'll be talking about a popular topic, and then it'll be like Lindsay Lohan, and then, oh, it comes back again. It's fascinating to look at that tool. So it's been very helpful to me in terms of determining the links of my videos and the topics if I notice that I talk about something and everybody drops off. So it's interesting.
Yeah,
who are the most popular celebrities?
Miley Cyrus, Megan Fox right now, who I can't stand. I mean, I like talking about Miley Cyrus and the Jonas Brothers, and, you know, those are really fun. But, like, Megan Fox, I just can't stand her. So it's fun to kind of get fired up about that. Or someone like John and Kate. It's funny how that is the most popular thing on all the magazines. But people on YouTube and online video, they're really not that interested in hearing about that. So that's not – I try not to talk about them, but then I get fired up about them. But that's not a – that people aren't searching for that type of content on YouTube. It's more – always Hannah Montana, Jonas Brothers. If something happened on Saturday Night Live that weekend, I'll try and cover that the following Monday. So I try and be, you know, on top of it like that. But I do enjoy seeing where people drop off. And I have shortened the length of my videos in the last, like, year, noticing that people have such short attention span.
Well, and I think that's something we started getting that data on some of the shows we were doing for on networks. And I know that as soon as we saw it, it changed the way we made our shows. You know, and that kind of data, I think, only makes better content when we're looking at, especially the diversification. You know, we don't have the money to do lots and lots of target audience, stuff. The target audience is the audience. I mean, like, you know, the test audience is the audience. We put stuff out, we see what they do to it, and we see how it comes back. So it is a very fascinating structure. Now, talking about this, actually, about people viewing stuff and looking at this, this is another story about watching this, and this is NBC Heroes, and this is from Business Week, and it said NBC's Heroes has been spared, you know, the axe because the ratings for the network drama were better than originally measured by Nielsen when digital video recorder viewership was factored in. This is a flawed logic, according to Daisy, I think that was the cut out of Business Week? Did you just cut it out of Business Week when you put it in?
Oh yeah, I don't do that much original work, Alex.
Just wanted to check. So this is, according to Business Week, they said this is flawed logic at its best and reveals how endangered the TV network model is. As reported by the New York Times, the ratings climbed from an anemic 2.6 to 3.7 when DVR viewership within a few days of the show's live airing was added in. That is enough, it seems, to keep the show on air, but why? DVRs allow people to easily watch programs whenever they wish. So the issue is that they're counting the DVRs into the overall ratings to say the show is still being watched by enough people. The problem, of course, is that everyone's fast-forwarding over them. And so the question is, should you count them from an advertiser's perspective? From a show's perspective, absolutely. From an advertiser's perspective, does it make sense to count these as part of what they're paying against and whether the show is actually viable? Daisy, what do you think?
Well, I think it's kind of silly because you hear these guys at TiVo and, you know, in other places talk about how you'd be surprised at how many people actually watch the ads on DVRs. Yes, I would be. Surprise me, because I have yet to see a valid data point from that actually syncs up with the real human experience. And what was so funny about this story was the writer said, let's face it, you know, 95% of what I watch is time shift with my DVR. The ads that don't get skipped fall under one of four scenarios. I've fallen asleep. I'm distracted by a magazine, my laptop, or my son. I'm in another room. I have died and no one has discovered my body. I mean, you can say that we might not be fast forwarding the ads, say, one third of the time. I'll hear that sometimes. That's a number that TiVo folks have talked about, that you know, ads might get fast forwarded 66% of the time. But wow, there's one third of the time that we're still watching them. We are not. We're peeing. We're doing other things. So I think it's important to know how popular a program is and to use that in turn to perhaps assess what resonates with consumers, what resonates with viewers in terms of planning programming. But I don't really think it has a lot of validity in terms of the advertising market.
Yeah, I time shift almost everything as well. So that's definitely the same issue. Now, of course, I have this odd thing with my son, who's 23 months old. I don't know if your kids are like this, has a laser focus for ads.
Oh, they love them.
He literally stops. He doesn't care about the rest of the show. The only show he'll watch with me is Alton Brown. Good Eats is the only, and I think it's something about him, Alton Brown, talking straight into the camera that my son finds interesting. But outside of that, he has no interest in any of the other shows, except when the ads come on, he will stop, and he gets a little upset with me if I start fast forwarding through them. So I'm inflicted, you know, with all these ads when he's awake. But otherwise, I've gotten really good at figuring out the 5X thing on my Comcast DVR, and you wait because when you see that last sweeper, you know to hit stop.
Michael, you watch a ton of TV. Are you watching most of it on your DVR? Are you skipping
the ads? Yeah, all I do is watch TV. I have two DVRs, two TiVos. I don't think I watch anything in real time. Maybe The View at 11 a.m. But the evening shows, I don't. And I purposely, I have two things going and I'll watch, I'm never watching TV in real time. And I think the only time and it's funny when people say, oh, did you see that commercial? I don't think I've seen a commercial in 5 years. So I have no reference of running jokes and commercials. And I have the only commercials that I watch now, and this is a great advertising strategy, is if it seems like it's part of the show, like Desperate Housewives, which I'm just watching right now, they have something with Sprint or something, and I read about it in TV Guide, it's a big marketing campaign using the actresses, and it seems like it's part of the show, so I always stop, and they have a little storyline going regarding the show, so I watch it by mistake, and I kind of like it, because it involves the show.
You see, now, my problem is, the only ad that I see is that when the iPhone ads come in, I stop, and see the new applications that I need to buy.
Junkie. Can I tell you one thing about my new Mac? I know that this is not Mac Break Weekly, but I have to tell you. Okay, so my hard drive died yesterday. I don't know why. And all things being equal, I would prefer that a hard drive not die. But I went to the Apple store, and they gave me a new computer. And I went home, and I plugged in my Time Machine. 15 minutes later, it was like I had my computer back. It was very nice. That was
You're more advanced than me. A lot of us tech guys, we don't use the Time Machine. We're all like, rah, 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 stupid Time Machine.
It's so much better than because I use Carbonate too, and I had some issues with that because there was one file I had backed up. I had backed up Time Machine on Wednesday night, basically, and I had accessed my computer last time on Friday morning because I was gone for the weekend. But there was only one file that I had worked on in the interim that I wanted to get. So I was trying to get it off of Carbonate, but Carbonate is really weird in terms of you have to back up the whole thing. And if you shut it down in the middle of a pending backup and blah, 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 blah. No, I thought Time Machine was fantastic. And like I said, I'd rather not have a hard drive die. But now that I've had one die,
you're going to be throwing that thing all over the place.
I'm on a Mac instead of a PC.
Okay. Well, and this, once again, we would tell everyone that Apple didn't give us any money. They didn't give us any computers.
God.
Not that we're bitter. Not that we didn't wish that they did, but no.
You don't have to do that till December 31st. Knock it off.
Well, I'm trying to get ahead of it. I'm trying to get used to it. Get it into the muscles here. So that's the interesting thing is that I think this is a challenge that online media can really make against standard broadcast is that we know, or theoretically we can tell people exactly how many people saw the ad. If the stuff is structured, TV is kind of this, we think there's that many people over there. It's kind of like counting the number of people who protest in Washington, D.C. It's, this block of people is 10,000, and we're just going to guess that it's 80,000 to 150,000. I mean, that's probably more accurate than TV. When you're talking about online, we really get to the point where we're going to get to the point where not only do we know whether you saw the ad or not, we're going to know whether you saw the whole ad or not. And I think that partially scary, I think, for some people, but I think that it also for producers creates a lot of opportunity, or at least a lot of accountability, which may not be opportunity, right? coming up, copyright trouble in Canada. So this is Access Copyright, the Canadian organization that collects royalties for writers, filed a, this is according to Boing Boing, a jaw-dropping dumb set of comments in the Canadian copyright consultation. Access Copyright came out opposing the right to record TV shows at home and the right to quote-unquote format shift your media. That means load a CD onto your MP3 player or put an old ebook into a new reader or phone. They say this that there is almost they also say that almost all commercial use, no matter how trivial, should require a license and should not fall under fair dealing. They come out against the interlibrary loan system because it is digital. Now, is this, I have to admit, Canada law tends to be a little out there from a U.S. perspective. Ours is bad enough and theirs tends to be worse. Is this something that we should expect to see here? What do you think, Daisy?
Well, I don't think so. I definitely feel that, you know, the fair use doctrine is pretty strong. I guess I think, frankly, it's a little bit silly, I had that in my notes to everybody. But what it got me to thinking, because Michael and I were actually having an exchange about copyright issues over email a week or so ago. He got a copy of my ebook that I did earlier in the year on fair use, and I was just kind of curious, since we've got him on the show and he's a creator. You know, what are some of the? I mean, Michael, what are the copyright issues that you deal with? Because you're regularly showing clips from movies and TV shows. You know, so from my vantage point, I would say that very clearly falls under fair use. But what have you dealt with both as a creator and, you know, with other people sort of trying to, you know, to use your content?
Yeah, I tend to not, I've never used a movie clip or a TV clip without permission. If I have a movie clip or a TV clip, I mean, they've sent it to me and it's okay. In terms of the other stuff, images and stuff that I use briefly, if I've ever gotten a copyright, I've always just said, oh, I was reviewing your show, and they take the strike away. So I've never had it. The only time I had a consequence was when I first started YouTube back in 2006, and I didn't know anything about it. I used to videotape the TV, and something happened on The Real World, and then I'd do a What the Buck talking about it. And Viacom, which I didn't realize, of course, was YouTube's arch enemy, flagged it. And since then, over the last 2 years, I've nicely written to Viacom at least once a year, and I've said, hi, you know, I'm really popular on YouTube, I make clips, this is my one strike on my account, I'll remove the video, I won't post, I'll get rid of it, but will you please remove the strike? And I've never heard back. So it was a lesson learned not to do that. But if I really wanted to pursue it further, I guess I would, you know, say, oh, fair use, I was doing a journalistic critique of your show and I showed literally 10 seconds of the show. Now I really don't use music much because I'm terrified of music. So I never use music unless I have permission. Even all the YouTubers ask me for advice, and I'm like, you know, talk to a lawyer, read Daisy's book. But, you know, like you even say in your book, there's not one clear answer. So don't think you're going to get one clear answer from a lawyer or from a book. But a lot of this also is really
leaned towards the copyright holder as far as YouTube, because they can just kind of capriciously flag yours off. There's not really any recourse, right?
Right. The only way in terms of the other question, watching my content, if people take my content and do something with it, like review me or make fun of me or, you know, show a What the Buck show and then my head explodes or they're stabbing me, which is funny and I don't mind. I don't care. Sometimes people take the entire video and repost it. And if I notice it's getting thousands of views and therefore impacting me getting thousands of views, I might say, oh, this is my video. I'll email them first. I'll say, will you please not post my whole video? So I try and stay. Yeah, but every time if I've ever had an issue, I've kind of fought it and won it. I'm doing a new show called Buck Factor, and I'm showcasing other YouTubers, and a lot of people are sending me covers of songs, and I'm like, oh, do you have any original songs? Because I don't even want to risk it with monetizing a cover. Some girl in my video this week, though, I played like 10 seconds of the cover. The song is kind of, it's not like it's, you know, it's weird. I'm always paying attention to it, though, and you know, trying to do the right thing.
Well, I know that we take a very careful line on all of this stuff. We don't play any music. We don't play any videos. It's just too much trouble. While I think we have the right to do it, I just don't have the energy to deal with the repercussions. And I think
I do live shows on Blog TV twice a week, and I'm always playing music and dancing around. And no one's ever said anything to me. And if they did, I guess I'd stop. But I love doing it, and it's so much fun. And it's literally a one-time thing. It's not like a YouTube video that's going to get millions of views and live on YouTube and generate revenue for years to come. It's like almost like a radio. I don't know. I don't mind. I would never do it in a YouTube video, but live on Blog TV, I just do it because it's fun.
Daisy, what do you think?
I think that one of the things, I think an important takeaway for other, you know, creators and producers from what Michael said is ask permission. I mean, really, it's such a simple thing. But when he was saying that, I thought, well, yeah, that makes perfect sense. You know, if you're going to be doing this on an ongoing basis, you know, whatever it is that you're going to be using, a lot of creators, you know, and especially if you have a show where, you know, you're regularly reviewing something and you need somebody's videos or whatever it is, you know, are often accommodating and helpful. And if they're not, then you know that you were better off not to include that in the first place. You know, I just think that, you know, there are general rules of thumb that should be followed. You should think twice and ask yourself, you know, is this something that I absolutely need to use in, you know, in my video, in my podcast or whatever it is? And am I adding something new to the work with my critique, commentary, or whatever it is? And, you know, if you can answer those, I mean, generally speaking, you'll be okay. But yeah, at the end of the day, you know, if there are nuances, you've got to consult an attorney. I mean, if there's a lot of money at stake, you know, don't mess around.
Well, and I think that if you can get a lot of these companies now have some kind of new media expert, and the key is trying to figure out who that person is and then take them out for drinks.
And, you know, Michael, I know some folks at Viacom. I want to do whatever I can to help you get that strike removed. So we'll talk about
that. Thanks. I'll send you the link. I'll send you the URL. I write them a nice email and I forward the URL. I do it at least once a year and I never heard back. But the other companies like Fremantle with America, I actually almost didn't cover American Idol last year because I was so nervous, because Fremantle goes in and even if you had tags American Idol or something, they were flagging all the videos and I'd always write the letter. Hi, I was just doing a review of the show. I love the show. And they'd always remove the strike. But being a high level YouTuber, it's too stressful to go through it sometimes, so you don't, you know companies not to mess with. But like and music now is so interesting on YouTube, how people will make a video and it'll come up, buy it on iTunes, buy it on Amazon. So it's great that YouTube has reached these music agreements. As long as you're not monetizing the video and you use it to text it and people can download it, and then it's win-win for everybody. Yeah.
Absolutely. Also in the news, we have this is according to an Australian site, is Web 2.0 winners and losers, according to the Sydney Morning Herald. And this is actually a really detailed article and definitely worth checking out. We'll have this in the show notes. And, you know, it really talks about, you know, the fact, you know, well, Daisy, give us a little.
Yeah, this is a great story. Actually, you know, I'm just going to go ahead and link it up after the show on Twitter for people to take a look. But it's a really sort of detailed story about gatekeepers and the digital revolution. And the story starts out with a reference to this YouTube orchestra that played in Carnegie Hall and then juxtaposes that with a Tucson kind of you know, just very local newspaper shutting down, and then just goes into, you know, things that we discuss a lot on this show, but the whole idea that there's no precise definition of Web 2.0, but, you know, it means Facebook, Flickr, open source, Twitter, Wikipedia, you know, all the things that we're regularly talking about. But there's this whole idea of, you know, are these sort of, as a collective, are these places really able to truly kind of, you know, knock down traditional media? You know, we've been seeing that happen in so many ways, but the story raises the issue of sort of like, how far can it go? And what value is there in a gatekeeper? I mean, this is a really interesting question, that a couple interesting questions directly from the story. Can readers, viewers, and listeners be trusted to identify the best without the guiding hand of authority? Is elitism necessarily a bad thing? And if the commercial underpinnings of, say, movie production collapse, does that matter? If blockbusters were to disappear and be replaced by low-budget independent productions, is that a problem? I just think those are all fascinating questions. It sort of raises the issue of, you know, is this a content apocalypse? Is this just like a free-for-all? But then more so, what are the risks and the rewards in this whole idea of the revolution of content creation that we're kind of experiencing right now? You know, what do we lose out on? And one of the things that I think is, you know, I think there's still a lot of value in you know, big shows, big productions, big books. I mean, there's still, you know, you can find some really terrific things out there. But I think that one of the important things to keep in mind is one of the benefits of big media and gatekeepers are that we don't have to sift through all of the crap. They do it for us. You know, that publish, that literary agents, for instance, you know, when I look at, you know, when I look at my world, I mean, they sift through a lot of the books that frankly, you know, don't really need to be out there, that need a lot of work, that aren't up to snuff. And then in turn, you know, they submit to publishers and publishers decide, you know, what they're going to publish. And not everything is great that's on the bookshelves, of course, but at least there's been kind of a process of vetting. And, you know, if you were to take this idea of sort of, you know, everybody getting a say in content to the extreme, then when you look at it in the world of books, what does that mean? Everybody just kind of throws their manuscript up on some collective site and, you know, people go read them and look at them and decide what's the best. I frankly, as a consumer, like the fact that there's been some vetting, because I don't have the time in my life to go vet content.
Well, but I would argue the one thing I'd say about that, though, is that the amount of vetting for books at this point has become much less than what we would consider for TV or film. I mean, the number of books that are released every day vastly eclipses TV shows or movies, you know, probably combined. Simply because there's just a lot more avenues to get into there, you know, and there's a lot of different many publishers and many different ways of doing it, and self-publishing at this point. I mean, books, when we look at it now, you go to Amazon, you can buy books from people that they were the piece. And I think that the problem with this conversation, and we've seen this from Keen, you know, Keen is the author who's always talking about the amateurish stuff, is that we hear this every single time there's a change in technology. Every time. I mean, it when movies came out, you know, it was the end of stage. When TV came out, it was the end of film, and it was the end of radio. End of radio. When VHS came out, it was the end of TV. You know, everything. You know, when you know, all of these different things. We always hear this. You know, my clearest vision of this is always when I was starting using Photoshop. I was an intern getting paid $4.50 an hour, competing with ad agencies who had big SciTech scanners, and I had Photoshop and a Mac LC. And I, you know, wrested away the design control, you know, from an ad agency for the company I was working at, saying I could do it, just buy me a big computer. And of course, during the early 90s, there was an enormous revolution of design, and it was an incredible amount of bad design, incredible amount of bad ads, bad magazine design, magazines that looked cool that you couldn't read. I mean, I think some of us remember Ray Gun, which was fantastic to look at and almost impossible to actually read. And all of that stuff just kind of went everywhere. And then we slowly collated back into something, you know, because what happens is I think it creates a lot of chaos, and then it all, you know, it goes out, becomes chaotic, but then what happens is everything percolates again, and a new leaders appear, because it isn't going to be everybody. It's not going to be everyone making the content. It's going to be people who understand that new technology kind of sifting up to the top. Michael, what do you think?
Oh, my God. Yes. No, maybe. What?
Question.
Yeah, it's funny because on YouTube, I when I started becoming successful, I remember 2 years ago, I heard from other top YouTubers who were generating revenue, like the film community and maybe the TV. I remember when I was interviewed, people are like almost resent the online people knowing you're making all this money and this is what you do. There's kind of like that, you know, that superiority thing. Right. Or even when I was doing press last year and the TV crews would come to my house and they'd be like, you know, and these are TV reporters and they're like interviewing me and they're just kind of, and then they kind of knew basically how much money I'd be making ballpark. And then you could just see in their face, like, I have a degree in journalism. I work for a major news network. This sucks that you're get to sit home and do this and not put on pants all day. Yay me.
So I think Michael is in favor of the content apocalypse. He's the beneficiary.
No, but I agree with what Daisy said about sifting through the crap. I mean, I subscribe to a gazillion magazines. I love magazines. I love reading the newspaper in my hands. So I'm all for that. You know, I agree. I wouldn't want to like have to sift through it. I agree with what you're saying, Daisy. I'm just saying. I remember when I became successful, that initial sort of, and I heard from other filmmakers on YouTube who you know, heard from people who were struggling to break in. And then there's that sense of, what did you do to struggle? Nothing, you know?
Well, and I think that there's an advantage to being, you know, there's a first move, what they call first mover status, which is an advantage to a lot of people. And then it really is going to come down to the people who can continue to stay on the front of the wave. And it's not going to be everybody. You know, it's going to be people who really are working at improving their craft, improving their audience, improving their show, you know, because people will get bored and there's a lot of options. And so, you know, I think that that's going to be the next round of this. And I think that's already happened to some degree. I think a lot of, you know, there's a lot of things that we saw that were really popular 3 or 4 years ago that, you know, we don't really watch that much anymore.
Would you? Agreed.
Yeah.
I agree. And the key is really keeping your audience engaged, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, was I talking over Daisy?
No, I think
go ahead. We like that.
I would just, it's so competitive now, whereas, you know, in like 06, 07, you kind of knew, oh, these are the web shows, these are the, and now it's like, whoa, everybody wants to jump in on this and do commentary and, you know, throw their 2 cents in and generate revenue doing this. It's crazy. But I just love it. I've always loved it. I always say I did it for 2 years, 50 hours a week, didn't make a dime. I just love doing it so much. So now that I'm just able to do it for a living, it's just so exciting. And I am constantly striving to, you know, get better, and just, I'm just enjoying it. And I'm very aware that there's a lot more when people go on YouTube, there's so many more choices now. And so I'm just, even though I have 600, I don't know how many thousand subscribers, I don't market myself or behave differently than I did when I had 300 subscribers, 3,000, 30,000, 300,000. I still make tremendous efforts to promote myself and engage the current and find new audience.
Well, yeah,
and
I came on Twim.
Yay! Hello, everybody. YouTube.com/box. See you there.
So we're gonna move on here. Speaking of internet and people watching it, this is from VideoBusiness.com. The internet video. What it's basically talking about is the fact that we're not seeing as much growth with the TV growth, but we are seeing a huge growth. TV is still growing, TV subscribership, but there's a huge growth in online viewers, as we all know, and we're starting to see U.S. online video viewers are spending about 45% more time per day watching videos on the internet than a year ago, and far less time watching TV. So it's not a this and that, but it really is becoming a this or that. And this gets back into that whole, what we were just talking about, this changing. And the real question, I think, I'm going to ask you, Daisy, is whether you, do you think that we're going to get to a point where it's just hard for the middle road TV to survive? I mean, I think the big budgets, they gather a lot of people, probably are going to do okay because they're still a certain group of people that want to watch those. But it's this kind of mid-budget stuff. Is that a hard place to live?
Well, you know, and that kind of ties back to what we were just discussing with the content apocalypse and sifting through things. And yeah, I do think, you know, that there's a bit of survival of the fittest going on right now, that because they're, you know, because of what's happening with DVRs that we talked about earlier in the show, just because of what's happening with the accessibility of production and content, everything that's out there. And now with people watching in new ways and in sort of new media ways, yeah, I think it's that there's going to be a winnowing. I mean, there's always been, you know, TV has been able to, and, you know, the internet, books or whatever, have been able to support, you know, a lot of other content, you know, based on big hits. And I think with budgets contracting, you know, with money tightening just in general, that, you know, that there's not going to be a riding on the coattails much longer, that you've got to be able to sort of support what you're doing based on what you're doing, not because the network has a lot of big hit shows, so you're, you know, they're going to let your show incubate for a little bit longer. I mean, I'm kind of talking in TV terms right now, but it sort of applies, I think, to, you know, to a lot of media. I think we're definitely seeing a lot less patience in terms of that incubation of new material, whatever it is right now.
Well, and I think also the this is just something I'm going to just touch on for just a second, but the Bloomberg buying Business Week. This is Bloomberg's main business is not really end user content, but you know, Business Week gives them access to a new new audience to deal with their core content.
They sell their terminals too, basically. I mean, that's what Bloomberg wants to do. They want to sell their terminals, and now they can get it in front of those Business Week folks.
Right, and so the thing is, but this is another way that I think a lot of people in media are making money. People who are still doing it, the outsiders that are kind of getting on the inside, are finding other ways of making money than a direct advertisement, other ways of making money than the standard operating procedure that we've seen in Hollywood. Michael, are you looking for kind of out of the box ways of generating revenue with your show?
Not really. No, it's weird because I'm just, I feel like I'm doing so well that I'm just really, not really. No, I get approached a lot for different things, and I'm happy with the revenue I'm making. So I'm just really enjoying it and focused on that. So I wouldn't say I'm an example of anything out of the box. I just try and stick to things that are, you know, what the buck appropriate. So it doesn't reek of something not true to what I would promote or mention anyway. So, yeah, I'm just enjoying it.
Are folks from traditional media reaching out to you to be a spokesperson? Not like a celebrity pitch man type of thing, but do you have conversations, you know, with TV studios or traditional folks at all about, you know, being like an online host for them or introducing like a series of online shows or something like that? I mean, have you had those conversations at all?
Sometimes, yeah. Sometimes they approach me, and I mean, basically, they just want the promotion on What the Buck. They want me to promote them, use my large audience. Because that's where my value is. Whenever I've been on TV, I'm not that valuable on TV. So it's like I could go into a TV studio and do something for you for a couple $100s, or I could stay home and do it for a couple $1,000s. So that's way more appealing to me, is to use my value with my large online audience. So I do have these conversations, but I think a lot of times they just know that I enjoy being home and making videos. I'm not completely averse to the idea of doing something on TV someday, but I'm just enjoying online video and my life as is so much. So I'm just, you know, nurturing that. And I get approached to like host events and stuff, but it's hard. Like, you know, oh, fly to California and do something for like 2 days. And it's like, I can stay home and make videos and, you know, make more money. And I love doing that. I love having complete control over my life and my content. So,
well, and one of the things is that we've been approached by a couple cable networks related to MacBreak. And one of the things that they wanted was exclusivity over the output of the video, so that it would only go out to their cable network, not out to back online. And one of the things that we just didn't think was going to happen, we didn't think we'd get more viewers on TV. you know, it's a specialty market, and we were afraid that our viewership would actually drop if we went to TV rather than grow. And I mean, that's partially a function of some of the networks that we were talking to. But I think that is that something you're concerned about, that your show might not even really carry on TV the way it's not the same audience, it's not the same background that you have online.
Yeah, it's not designed. It never even occurred to me, oh, What the Buck should be on TV. I enjoy doing small segments. I'm not concerned about that. I think the thought when I started YouTube was everybody's like, oh, this is, you're very funny, you're good at this, you should be one of those people who stands there on Entertainment Tonight. No, thank you. My career goals have changed. Like, this is what I love doing. So I'm not concerned about TV or my place or. The only reason I would like to be on TV is if it could help my online branding. But let me tell you, I've been on Fox News. I've made, you know, dozen appearances on E. It never leads to more online traffic. So, I mean, it's more like, it's more for your family. Like, oh, they see you on E and they think you're, I'm like, no, this is, right. You know, they think that's cool. Or you're on the front page of the paper and they think that's cool. So the only reason traditional media, it's good in terms of giving you a little more cred for some things. Like, oh, that's Michael Buckley. He was on the front page of the New York Times. Or, oh, he was on E. But I'm like, you know, my biggest success and financially and emotionally and everything is online. So.
Right. Yeah, and I think that also one of the other competitors isn't just smaller people doing entertainment video. I think that one of the things that is a big part of our business, of course, is corporate clients who are learning that because there's no control over who puts the video out now, they can interact with their customers directly. And that's going to be, I think, a big market. And once again, it just chews up, you know, FaceTime in front of the screen. And I think I do think that you end up with a situation where you end up with a lot less people watching a lot of the videos. And when I say mid-range videos, I think a lot of cable does pretty well, but we've seen a lot of this like kind of mediocre broadcast, you know, network television. And I think those are the areas that are starting to, I think are going to start to struggle because there's not super compelling reasons to watch them. And the ERs, I think there's a lot of compelling reason, there's a lot of production value, but I think there's ones that are kind of in between, and you really have to question whether you really want to spend your time watching something just to fill time, because now you can fill time with 1,000 different things. Daisy?
On that note, I need to sign off, guys.
We're done.
How does that sound? Shall we wrap it up?
I'll show you. Daisy, where can people find you?
You can find me at daisywhitney.com, where you'll be able to watch my new Medium Minute. And I'm also revamping the website for my author blog, where I'm,
nice.
You know, I'm kind of blogging about 2 or 3 times a week, sort of about the process of writing and, you know, just things about, you know, just kind of be, you know, edit the editing process with the Mockingbirds. I should be getting notes from my little brown editor any day now. So I will, I'll link that up when that's live. So some fun stuff happening there. That's where you can find me.
Thanks. And Michael, where can people find you?
BuckHollywood.com, YouTube.com/Buck. I post pretty much every day this week, new episode of What the Buck. And follow me on Twitter at Buck Hollywood. My tweets are really good. Some people suck at Twitter. I could write a book. I'm really good at Twitter.
Gives good tweets.
Yeah.
This mess that you've been listening to is This Week in Media. We are over and out.
Yay. Woo-hoo.